welcome to Dear Hank and John.
Or as I prefer to think of it, Dear John and Hank.
It's a podcast where two brothers answer your questions, give you dubious advice, and bring you all the week's news from both Mars and AFC Wimbledon. John,
yep.
Do you know how to make an octopus laugh?
I don't.
You got to give him 10 tickles.
Because of 10 tentacles and 10 tickles.
Yeah, I don't actually giving an octopus tentacles doesn't actually help it because it's already got a bunch. But
right, well,
it's still funny.
No, it's not. But you've identified why it's not funny, which I feel like is the first step.
Which is that it doesn't work both ways. It only works one way.
Yes, for the joke to be good, it has to work two ways. But I would argue that for the joke to be good, it has to not fundamentally be a pun.
It's just a difference
in worldview.
Yeah. Well, we're doing it. Everybody's themselves, as Catherine says.
I've been thinking about octopuses, because you and I were just talking, Hank, about how humanity is the only known species so far in the history of Earth to be like, you know what? Maybe we should stop going for more, right? Like every species is
not
constantly...
as like a unit, just for clarity.
No.
But definitely individuals.
Yeah, and like that we are concerned about the implications of us going for more, which at least from what we have observed is not something that can be said about deer or raccoons or cyanobacteria.
Yeah. No, it definitely seems like there's a pretty big pressure toward like evolution. The genes that get passed on are the ones that that get passed on. So if you don't have a drive to do that, then you don't. Then your traits don't get passed on. That's how it works.
Yeah, and there's some fundamental desire that I don't think we all the time understand or think about to not just make more of ourselves, but to make. To create out of the materials of the universe something which did not exist before, as William Faulkner put it. But then we started talking about how actually it's possible that we aren't the only species to have ever been like, hold up, this may have gotten a little bit out of control. And that maybe like there was a group of cephalopods who had a whole octopus civilization.
Well, and I think like this fascinates me because if it's like on the bottom of the ocean,
we wouldn't know.
And if it was long enough ago,
we wouldn't know.
How would we know?
Especially if a lot of their monument making, assuming that they were even into monument making, a lot of that could have been things that were intentionally made to be temporary. It could have been that was part of their worldview.
Or and maybe so, they're like built out of shells. And so we just like find a bunch of shells and we're like, a bunch of shells.
Right. And we come up with some explanation for why like the tides did it. But no, it was the octopus civilization. It seems like to me that that's the only plausible one. Like I think if dinosaurs had like government and democracy and stuff, we would have found some of their voting stations. But I feel like octopuses maybe got away with having a civilization. And then I can totally, like having seen a few octopuses in my life, I can totally imagine a situation where like they would get together and they would be like, you know what? Things have gotten pretty crazy here.
It's a little out of hand.
The wars and the specialization of labor.
Whatever octopus Twitter was, they were like, this is a bad idea.
We made this octopus Twitter where we just yell at each other and then we let the most powerful octopus in the world become the sole owner of octopus Twitter. And like maybe this whole thing with radical structural inequality is the wrong path forward and we need to just chill out and be octopuses again.
And it does seem like that makes sense because they seem smarter than they need to be. Octopus just seems smarter than it needs to be. So it's like they decided one day, how about instead we all live for 2 years, we're pretty happy the whole time, we play a bit, we chill out, and mostly we just sort of zone.
Right. Like how about like the way that humans feel when they're playing like level 7 on Tetris is the way that we should feel all the time.
All the time.
That's like... What if instead of inventing Tetris, we just had that vibe overall? Yeah.
And then one octopus was like, but I like the fact that we can keep the sharks out of the town. And they were like, Steve, you're going to have to go. We outvoted you. You're food now. Give me 10 tickles.
that was like the ceremony that was immediately preceded the renegade octopuses being thrown outside the city walls to be eaten immediately by sharks was yeah. Steve, the renegade octopus, would have to stand at the gates, and then 10 friends and 10 enemies would each give him a tickle. And then they would open up the gate and shoot him out into the regular ocean where the sharks await.
Yeah.
Because, you know, like they had that. Their own. That's the thing. Like, they had their own immorality. They had their own structural horrors. You know,
oh, of course,
they had their own ways of like kicking people out of the community for being overly radical. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So by virtue of having morality, they also had evil, unjust structures. And eventually they were like, hey, instead of reforming these structures and trying to make them better, which, by the way, I think is the right call for humans, just yes. to be clear, uh-huh. maybe the octopuses were like, God, let's just, you know what? Let's just be octopuses again.
Yeah, they figured out a switch to flip in their brains where they're just like feeling okay. And that's
possible.
That's the way.
Yeah. That like once a year, without our knowing it, the switch flips and they all meet somewhere in the ocean and they vote about whether to continue to be octopuses or whether to have a civilization again.
I think it's better that way.
Civilization's the wrong word, but you know what I mean.
It's better that way. Like there's no doubt in my mind that all of this is made up, so it might as well that should be the thing. For sure.
Because I think that's a really good movie.
Right. Well, do they even have to get together, or do they have some kind of like, they just like sink their tentacles into the soil and they can communicate through.
Yeah, they do it telepathically.
Bacteria or something.
Right. Yeah. They do it through like fungal networks, like how trees talk. Yeah. And so they're like, it's May 14th, time for the big vote. I vote to continue being an octopus and not living in a city.
And then, but like every year, like it's getting more 50-50 because they're looking at us, yes. and they're like, we're going to have to do something about these people.
Right, exactly.
They're like swimming down and looking at us.
They're starting to be a problem.
They made a Netflix documentary about it. now a bunch more are doing it because they like this Netflix documentary.
Yeah, the octopuses are like, they're finding out our big secret. And so maybe we need to move to cities again. And then there will be the great rivalry between the humans and the octopuses, and humans will finally be united.
That's right.
Because there will be a common enemy.
Yeah. Yeah. They're fairly big and quite strong. So we'll see how we do.
They could take us. They've been around a lot longer than we have.
I mean, they're 100% muscle. Like they just are, they don't even have bones. It's all muscle.
I think it'd be kind of great if we agreed that the oceans were going to be for them and the land and the fresh water was going to be for us. And yeah. we were like, starting now, we can only eat things from the land and the fresh water because our octopus overlords have taken control of the oceans.
I mean, I know too much about where calories come from to think that would be an easy transition, but I think we could do it eventually.
Good party. Let's answer some questions from our listeners.
John, this first question is from Anne, who asks, Dear Hank and John, why is it harder to wake up on days that are cold, rainy, or dark? It's like my body can sense that the weather is gray and says, no thanks, before I'm even conscious and fights to stay asleep. Why is that? Can I blame science? Greens and Gables, Anne. Cute.
Anne, we're mammals.
Yeah, we are.
It's so hard to remember this on a minute-by-minute basis.
I know.
But
so
we
weird.
Are mammals.
It's so weird.
We are
weird.
We are so much more like kangaroos than we are like computers. We are mammals. So we do mammal stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like we put recently killed plant and animal matter into our mouth holes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then
we
use the slow fire of burning it inside of us to listen to yes. podcasts.
Yes. And so when we wake up and it's cold or rainy or dark, it's like when a fox wakes up and it's cold or rainy or dark. There's a part of the fox that's like, I'd rather not.
Well, and it's probably might be better to just rather not if there's no other drive. Like if you're not currently having a biological need, definitely it's cold and rainy and dark. Stay in. That's going to be
right.
It's going to be expensive metabolically to deal with that.
Exactly. So it's a value calculation that your mammal body is making that mammal wise, it's going to be more work than it usually would be to deal with this cold and rain and dark. Mm-hmm. And later, it may not be cold or rainy or dark. And so you may be able to get the same good stuff, the same recently deceased plant and animal matter into your mouth hole without having to do the extra work of being cold and wet.
That's right. And there's also like it is like biochemical when it comes to light detection specifically. So like if it's warm in your house, you probably don't know what's – well, I do. I mean, I know it's cold outside when it's cold outside. I can feel it coming through the walls. It's cold in Montana. But we also like have very sophisticated light detection systems that like you don't necessarily even need your eyes to be open for, but also you probably have your eyes open a little bit before you technically wake all the way up. And so you're getting that feedback. So during the dark months that we certainly have at these latitudes where I am, your body knows when the sun is coming up. And there's a thing called the suprachiasmatic nuclei. It's in the hypothalamus.
Mm-hmm. I've got a bunch of those.
It responds to light that goes through the retina. And it uses that to figure out what your body should be doing sleep-wise. So like it's a part of your brain that's connected to your eye receptors.
Yeah.
Wild.
That is pretty wild.
And it's called the suprachiasmatic nuclei, which that's a great name.
Biologists are so notoriously bad at naming things, but that is a really high quality name.
It's hard to forget.
Do octopuses have one of those, Hank? I imagine they don't because they aren't as light sensitive as we are.
Their brains are very different. So this is one of the coolest things about octopuses is they have very complicated brains that evolved entirely separately from ours. Like the nearest common ancestor of a cephalopod and a mammal is very deep and did not have a big brain. So their brains are super different. So I would be very surprised if they had any analogous structure.
Cool. Well, this next question comes from Sophie, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, I'm a preschool teacher. And recently one of my students asked, why if I jump, I come back down, but if I hold my arm up, it stays up? I tried to explain gravity to a 3-year-old, but thought it was a pretty profound question that you could answer. Gravity and existential dread, Sophie."
It's interesting that like putting my arm up, it doesn't feel like it's going to come down on its own. So that like, so there's the question of why I come back down, which is very complicated and weird and has to do with the curvature of space time. But then there's the question of like why my body doesn't really have to work to keep my arm up, even though it definitely is working. But I do not notice that work.
Wait, if you hold your arm directly out from your shoulder.
Oh, out to my shoulder, it wants to fall like crazy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, you're saying like if you make the
straight up,
the field goal was good.
Yeah.
Or
I'm like Mrs. Johnson.
Raising your hand to ask a question. Now, what I would have this 3-year-old do is I would say, well, let's see about that 3-year-old. Put that hand up and call me in an hour.
I raked about 8,000 pounds of leaves yesterday, so I'm already feeling it.
Yeah, it will eventually start to want to return to equilibrium.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, there's
you're just sort of like keeping it balanced up there more than holding it up there. It's like a broom on your fingertip, you know?
Yeah,
it's just balanced.
Yeah, I don't think that we need to think about it primarily as gravity if we're trying to explain it to 3-year-olds. Like, I don't think we need to talk about the curvature of space-time. But it is a weird idea, right? Because then why is it relatively little work to stand up or to sit down rather than lying down? Like, it doesn't feel like effort to be seated for most people most of the time. But
especially preschoolers who are tiny and don't have a lot of body to move around.
And they have a massive amount of energy relative to their mass, right? Like, like Sonic the Hedgehog is based on a 3-year-old. And I think that the answer is muscles. So I wouldn't talk about gravity or space-time. I would talk about muscles and how muscles do work. And
you are holding that up. But when you jump, there is nothing to hold you up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You are holding your arm up. You are holding yourself up when you stand. But when you jump, there's nothing touching the ground to hold you up. Does that work for a 3-year-old?
I think so. Yeah, I think so.
I haven't had a 3-year-old in so long. Jeez.
I know. Yeah. I mean, it's been a while even for me. Oh, this next question comes from Jay, John. I loved this one and it was hard to get to the bottom of. Dear Hank and John, do magnets ever stop magneting? Pumpkins and Penguins, Jay. So I'm not sure, but here's something that I did not realize that I figured out while researching this question, is that all natural magnets, so most magnets you'll deal with are created intentionally by people.
Right.
So like neodymium magnets, or like the magnet you stick out like with the, like the black background that's just like a film. That's a artificially induced magnet created by humans doing human stuff. But there are natural magnets. You know this because like there, before we could do that, there were like compasses that used lodestones that were magnetite, a mineral that is magnetic. And that was recognized fairly early on because it's super weird.
Yeah.
And very magical.
Right. Like that must have felt very much like magic. To be fair, not to quote the Insane Clown Posse, but magnets still feel a little magical to me.
They do. Yeah. I have not really gotten there. I think I know people who are in it enough that they're like, oh, yeah, no, that's just a normal phenomenon. I'm like, I can't push these two things together.
Exactly.
They fight. It's invisible.
That's weird that there is an invisible power that's keeping these things apart.
Yeah. So this natural, like in order for a natural magnet to form, I was like, does that happen naturally? Like, would it just like, do these atoms line up in a way that the spins of their electrons, blah, 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 or whatever? It happens because they form in our magnetic field of the Earth. So the Earth was the magnet that induced the magnetism in the lodestone, in the iron, so that it has a magnetic, it carries basically the Earth's magnetic field, kind of. Like the field induced the dipole, it induced it to have a direction to its magnetic field. And so if it was on a planet that didn't have a magnetic field, there would be no natural magnets.
Whoa.
And that, so like that says to me that maybe like just the random jostlings and energy of not being an absolute zero might eventually mean, once it's taken out of the presence of the Earth's magnetic field, that probably over the very long scheme of billions of years of, or hundreds of billions of years of the future of the universe, probably a natural magnet or any magnet would lose its magnetism. But I'm not sure. I couldn't figure it out.
But we're talking about very large timescales.
Yeah, for sure. It's not something that would happen unless you intentionally did it, which you can do in a number of ways.
Could you get rid of the Earth's magnetic field on purpose?
No, not yet. We do not. We cannot do that. And I think we are a long way away from having the power to do that.
Great. Let's never learn how to do that.
You can potentially create a kind of artificial magnetic field for another planet. It would be like an external device that would sit between the sun and the planet, and that would sort of block the solar radiation.
Mm.
But that's definitely within like sort of imaginable human technology, whereas stopping the Earth's core from doing stuff is not within imaginable human technology. It'd be easier to blow the planet up, it feels like.
Well, speaking of all that, I have a related question, sciencey, from John, who writes, "Dear John and Hank, do I weigh less on a mountain? My engineering friends and I have been arguing about this for 30 minutes. Help, moguls and mountains, John."
Yeah.
You do,
yeah,
right?
You weigh less on a mountain. Yeah. Yeah.
And the higher the mountain, the less you weigh, right?
Yeah.
And then if you had a mountain, like if you had a theoretical mountain that went all the way into outer space, I think actually you'd have a big problem now that I think about it.
You'd have a catastrophic failure. The issue would be air,
right? But also, like if you had a piece of the planet that pierced the atmosphere, wouldn't that be a problem?
No.
Wait. You could have a planet where almost all of the planet has an atmosphere, but then if you climb up a really, really, really tall mountain, you are in space.
Yeah.
Are you sure? That sounds wrong. Because doesn't the atmosphere definitionally sphere the atmos?
It's I don't know what the atmos is, but
you
it definitely
know.
Spheres the center of the Earth. So it spheres the center of the body.
Whoa.
It does not like head up on over whatever there is.
Whoa.
That's why the air pressure is much less at the top of Mount Everest than at sea level.
You're telling me.
Because it's higher up in the atmo.
You're telling me that the atmosphere is not actually an atmosphere for Earth's surface. It's an atmosphere for Earth's core.
Yeah, I guess.
Whoa.
It's at a, yeah.
Seriously?
Well, it's like it's subject to the, it's for the exact same reason as you weigh less at the top of the mountain. You are being the atmosphere falls like any like water would falls into a pool at the lowest point it can.
You're telling me that I could build a spire,
uh-huh,
a Tower of Babel, if you will.
Yeah, just
that goes all the way to the moon.
Well, okay, sure.
Just as a hypothetical. Uh-huh.
To the moon's orbit. Let's say to the moon's orbit, because we create a problem with the moon moving around otherwise.
Right. If it went to the moon, then it would sort of like rotate around Earth and it would scourge the land as it moved. That would be an issue. But you're telling me that I could build from the surface of Earth a tower that went to the moon's orbit, and this would not in any way affect the atmosphere. It would not really pierce the atmosphere because the atmosphere isn't pierceable as such.
Right. Yeah. It would affect the atmosphere, and then it would create like winds would current around it. Like when winds blow across it, it would create currents like a mountain does, you know,
Right. But it wouldn't like have any kind of catastrophic impact on the existence of the atmosphere.
It's not like I poke a hole in the bubble of...
Man, I mean, the movie Spaceballs fundamentally lied to me in a way that I didn't know until just now.
Yeah, well,
like, I so assumed Spaceballs. That it was correct. I thought that it was a documentary, Hank.
Oh, God.
I'm really astonished to know that you can pierce the atmosphere and nothing bad happens. Like, you could grow a mountain, and I intend to now.
Yeah, well, there's a theoretical idea for efficient space travel called the space elevator that is that. It's just a big,
wow,
big tower, basically, that goes up to a body that orbits the Earth and connects the planet to that. And then you sort of like get out of the gravity well that way.
Wow.
And just by climbing the tether.
Wow.
And it's a real idea that people think maybe someday would happen. I don't think it would, because if it broke and fell, and as you may have heard, what goes up does come down. On the way down, it would do so much damage. Like maybe, like it's just like building a doomsday device. It's very fun in theory, but thinking about what would go wrong if it did go wrong, I don't like.
Well, Hank, you love to spoil parties with your big what if it went wrong ideas. And I'll tell you what, Hank, nobody ever became a centibillionaire by imagining what the negative implications of their technology proposals were, okay? Nobody ever became a capitalist god king by worrying about the potential pitfalls.
Good point, John. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop worrying.
How I learned to stop worrying and love the space
how
elevator.
How I learned to stop worrying. Yeah. This question comes from Zoe, who asks, "Dear Hank and John, what's the difference between an ology and an onomy? Astrology and astronomy are two very different things with astro, but they are changed by their suffix. My hypothesis is that an ology was artsy and onomy was sciency, but what about like all of the other ologies? And then there's also graphy and metry. The list goes on and on. This has been tearing me up for weeks. Please help, sincerely. And Zoe, meet again."
Oh, that's good.
Okay, sure. All right. Yeah. I wasn't on board until I said it out loud.
Graphy is pretty easy. It's a writing-y. So a biography is a writing-y bio. And an autobiography is
a... Yeah, and I guess geography.
Yep.
Geograph is like, got to write down the Earth.
Yep.
Got to draw
It's writing the Earth. And autobiography is writing the autobio. Mm-hmm. I don't know about onomy and ology. Do you know?
Yeah. Apparently, the metry actually is to measure.
So geometry is measuring the geos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So astronomy, it's interesting because astrology and astronomy literally are the opposite of what they should be. So astrology is the study of astro, stars, and astronomy is the naming of astro, stars.
Oh.
And astrology is the... naming of stars.
Yep.
And astronomy is
the studying of stars.
The studying of stars, which is backwards.
Right.
It's precisely the opposite of what it should be, but language is bad and messy.
Yeah, but that's good to know that there is a different word for the study of something than for the naming of something. So actually, I would be very interested in, so if you took the word biography and then you made it about the naming of the bio, what would that be? That would be bionomy, right?
Yeah. I looked it up and it's actually like it's this says that it is in fact the management or measurement of the said field of study.
Okay.
So I was wrong. I always thought it was naming.
I like naming a lot better.
Me too.
But I was going to say, I don't actually want to write a biography of a disease or of a person, the stuff that I'm writing right now. I want to write a biology of the person or the subject. And then I realized that biology is actually it's already taken. It's already been occupied.
Very much so.
That space.
Yeah, that's interesting that there's like that a biography and a biology are really different.
Yeah, but actually what I am interested in is not writing down the story of something, but like finding ways to name things that haven't been named effectively, at least in my opinion. Like that's really for me what all writing is trying to name or give form or structure to stuff that doesn't easily lend itself to form and structure. And that would be great if there were some word that I could use for my understanding of what I'm trying to do with writing. But biology is taken, so I give up. What about autobiology? Do you think I could make autobiology the art of writing memoir?
Autobiology is just medicine. It's like human anatomy.
Yeah. How pretentious would it be if I wrote an autobiography and titled it something : an autobiology? So
Ooh,
pretentious.
Very bad.
So,
very
pretentious. So
John, can I tell you something?
It's so cringe.
The other day, I almost tweeted and then I didn't because that's the right way to do it, that I was hoping somebody could coin a term that would be grand schemism because of this thing that you said in a video a while ago that in the grand scheme of things, blah, 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 but we do not live in the grand scheme of things. And grand schemism being the sort of tendency of the powerful to think more about what will be and the sort of imagined future that may or may not happen and less about the current problems that are not being interfaced with.
Right.
And that would be grand schemism, which
I love that.
I
don't know why you didn't tweet that. I think that's lovely. I think that I do know why you didn't tweet it. And I think that every tweet you don't tweet is a good decision, period, hard stop. No other thoughts about that. But I do think that I understand the fascination with grand schemism. And I understand the importance of it, even of trying to think about the grand scheme of things. But when grand schemism consumes the reality of present tense injustice and suffering, I'm not as convinced by it.
Yeah.
Like there's a sort of grand schemism that holds that the main work we should be doing is toward alleviating future suffering. And I understand the argument, and I think it's an interesting argument. I just also think that when we encounter suffering in the present, and we do, we should respond.
Yeah, I have a couple of feelings about this. One is that it may be that the best way to alleviate future suffering is to interface with present suffering.
I think that is very often the case.
That seems kind of given, and like it might be a little unusual for there to be situations where the opposite is the case.
Right. Right. There are situations where the opposite is the case, for sure.
Yeah.
But
I think that it's easy to sort of like pretend like you found one, and so don't bother me with all of this complexity of dealing with things. But I also think that like it's really important for the stability of the world, like. In general, for us to be interfacing with current suffering. Like, if we just sort of say, like, don't worry, your grandchildren will be fine, that's not good That's not going to help actually solve the problem and get people on board to solve the problem.
Right. Don't worry. We're doing everything we can to make the world better for your grandchildren is...
Yeah. When someone's 20, you know?
Right. And maybe I think there are times and places where that can be a compelling argument. But
yeah.
I think for me, it makes sense to look at where the incentives align just on a practical human level. Where does... addressing present tense suffering also lead to generational improvements. And mm-hmm. I think there are plenty of those places for me. So I don't want grand schemism to like, I think it adds something important to the conversation that we need to pay attention to and listen to. I also think
that's why I, cause like when I wrote it, it just seemed like it was snarking off and like
it wasn't
as if grand schemism was something to be entirely discounted.
Yeah. I think the big risk with...
It's so hard not to have things sound like that.
On Twitter. That's true.
Especially also when you're boiling them down to a term, you know? It's almost like it would only ever catch on if it was a way to deride others.
Right. Like the term manic pixie dream girl or, you know, all those like ways of simplifying complexity are always kind of exciting to us because we're like, finally, here is a framework through mm-hmm. which I can understand everything.
And also dislike the people I dislike.
Right, yes, and have my previous biases confirmed.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you please present me with a way for me to dislike the people I dislike? I will totally retweet that.
And is there any way that along the way I can feel less like I have personal changes that I need to make in my own life to make the world suck less?
Yeah, totally.
Which I am more guilty of than almost anyone. I love somebody explaining away my evil.
Uh-huh. please make it okay for me to make the decisions I want to make, please.
Right.
It's a lot of it. And like that's what it is what we want. And so I at least know that a lot of the decisions I make are the ones I shouldn't be making. So at least there's that.
Right.
One step at a time, I guess.
Yeah.
This next question comes from Em, who asks, Dear Hank and John, where should I get my next tattoo?
Oh, finally.
Now that Hank's joined the tattoo club, I'd love your advice. This will be my fourth tattoo. I have one on the left side of my stomach, one on my right lower calf, one on my right inner arm. Where should my fourth one be? If it helps, it's of a mushroom and a gum nut. M. What's a
gum nut?
it's some kind of
feels like it could go in multiple directions. That's all.
It's the hard woody fruit of trees of the genus Eucalyptus.
Oh,
there's something called a snuggle pot and a cuddle pie.
Oh,
they're the gum nut babies of author Mae Gibbs.
Oh,
so grand. I'm gonna look up snuggle pot now, and I bet I'm gonna be delighted.
I am looking up gum nuts right now, and I am already delighted that they are adorable. They are, I think, my favorite hard and woody fruits that I've ever come across.
Yeah, actually, snuggle pot and cuddle pie, I have to say, I a little bit am freaked out by. I thought it was going to be 100% great, and in fact, they're kind of terrifying.
Oh, yeah, they don't, at least from the book that I'm looking at, they don't really seem to have pupils. They seem to have those dead ghost eyes.
Yeah, their pupils are white, and they apparently don't seem to be capable of closing their eyes.
You know, in the old days,
children's you could get away with anything.
Children's entertainment was just sort of naturally horrifying. The presumption was children know the secrets, but we can't tell them the secrets. They just have to sit there with the deep knowledge of them. And that led to all kinds of weird stories. Like, you go back and you read those Hans Christian Andersen stories, and you're like, oh, wow, yikes.
Yeah.
Yikes. We're really telling children
Oren
the
reads
secrets.
That stuff, and he's like, I don't want to read that. I don't know. Don't do that.
These gumnut babies look to me, they have this, like, perpetual surprise in their faces.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a horrified surprise. It's sort of like... You told them, like, they just found out that not only is human life temporary, but Earth and our solar system are also temporary. And they're like,
that's the look.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And you're like, anyway, baby, have a good evening.
Eventually, there will be like an even temperature throughout the entire universe, and nothing will ever change again.
We call it no
forward and no backward. We call it heat death.
We call it heat death, because it's like the final death.
That's after the exact all the, face.
After all the other face. Deaths happen, it's yeah. the last one.
The last so, death.
Yeah.
We so should anyway, probably call it that. Actually,
it's a ways off, Gumnut babies. But you know,
but eventually there will be no one left to remember that you existed.
The good news is, by the time the heat death of the universe comes, Gumnut babies will be long gone. You've got nothing to worry about yourselves, unless you are hoping for there to be some vestige of you in the future, yeah. which there yeah. won't be. Thank you for coming to our party.
Anyway, I'm hoping it's not Snugglepot that you're getting the tattoo of. And it's
I'm
kind of
hoping it is Snugglepot.
Either way, I think it's grand, and I want to see a picture.
Hank, don't answer the question, because I know you all got right. a tattoo. You didn't tell me that you got a tattoo. I had to discover it for myself, which was a little bit disappointing that you.
Well,
didn't
I wasn't sure what the etiquette was. I think that this is actually a great question. It's from Hank, who asks. How, like, when you're, like, middle-aged, or anytime, what's the tattoo telling etiquette? Do you, like, say, hey, mom, just so you know, I'm at the tattoo parlor and I'm going to permanently, no?
No, but here's when you could have mentioned it, is when I said, hey, how'd your trip with your buddies to Florida go? And you said, good. You could have been like, good, I got a tattoo. But you didn't. You just said, good.
What I said... I told you that I had a really good. I did tell you I had a great time. It was very relaxing. We had a wonderful time. But I maybe was like, and we all went and got matching tattoos.
I think that would have been the time to mention that you got a matching tattoo. But I also think it's fine for me to just find out by looking at your arm. I think that's fine.
It was a great TikTok.
I think that we should say where we think this tattoo should go on three. Okay.
Okay.
One, two, three.
Wrist.
Forehead.
What did you say?
Yours is probably better.
Do you say forearm?
Forehead. I just think it'd be so funny to have these snuggle bunnies right there, like almost as a third eye.
I'm all about, like, I think tattoos on arms are great because they're easy to show off.
Right.
And I just like an arm with some tattoos on it. I love an arm with some tattoos. It just looks real good.
I like upper arm. I like back.
I like back.
Yeah. But I also think that this is a decision about your body.
It's true. That
Hank
you should
and John
not leave up
should
to
not
us.
Make for you. Like, I think that you should think about your particular body and your particular relationship with it, where you would like seeing the tattoo, because you will be the main person who sees it, or where you would like to feel its existence, if that's
for sure.
what it is, and then go from there.
Mine feels very lonely. I have this one tattoo on my arm.
Are you going to get another one now?
It feels like it needs friends.
Are you thinking about getting another one?
I feel like I've got ideas, but I just want to let things happen, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's great. I support you 100% unless you want to get one of these snuggle bunny tattoos. That would worry me a little bit.
I thought they were going to be so cute. Their names were very cute.
Oh, anyway, that reminds me that today's podcast is brought to you by Snuggle Bunnies. Snuggle Bunnies, they're celebrating their centenary in 2019, according to this website I just found.
This podcast is also brought to you by magnets. Magnets, either created by humans or by the Earth. That's all the magnets.
And today's podcast is brought to you by Cold, Rainy, and Dark Mornings. They're not fun for mammals, and you're a mammal.
And this podcast is brought to you by Octopus Twitter. Octopus Twitter shut down over 200 million years ago.
Over the loud complaints of the world's largest octopus, who was like, hey, if you delete Octopus Twitter, it's going
to... so much value for me.
You're going to be removing so much value from my gigantic octopus life.
But all of your descendants were much, much happier.
We also have a Project for Awesome message from Emma in Jacksonville to Rachel. Dear Rachel, congrats on graduating from law school. You are a brilliant and kind friend, and the world is better for you being here. I cannot wait to visit you, and I apologize for not getting you an actual card, but I figured this would make up for it. I'm looking forward to fighting the meese with you for many years to come. The correct plural of moose is meese, according to this Project for Awesome
message. Why are they fighting mooses?
Who knows?
Why are they doing that?
Well, I think they're fighting moose, to be fair, which is the plural of moose.
Nope, they're fighting meese. This episode of Dear Hank and John is brought to you by Blue Land. The inside of your toilet is gross, and that's why you shouldn't let anyone in your household drink out of it, including your dogs, please. They let them close the thing, let them drink out of the bowl. The toilet is where the poop goes. There is an easy way to clean your toilet, though. Blue Land's sustainable toilet cleaner tablet. Just drop it in, watch it fizz, brush it up, and then flush. It's super easy, and the great thing about Blue Land is they are figuring out how to do all this stuff without any plastic at all. Blue Land is on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and for the planet, and with the same powerful clean that you're used to. It uses no single-use plastics in any component, from bottles, tablets, to wrappers, and even to shipping. The tablet packaging, by the way, is fully compostable. Blue Land products are effective and affordable. The toilet tablets are proven to work on a range of toilet stains, including rust, mineral deposits, limescale, and hard water. And look, when it comes to me, I don't really care that much about bacteria in the toilet, because again, that's where the poop goes. That's where it's supposed to be dirty in there. But it is nice to have something to help you with those mineral deposits, which we have in abundance in Montana. You can get even more savings by buying refills in bulk or setting up a subscription. Their subscriptions are customizable and convenient, so you never run out of your most used products. We have been a Blue Land household for like 3 years now. It's super convenient, super good. Like it a lot. The products look nice. They're easy to use. And again, they do not require single-use plastics or shipping a bunch of water around, because it's like the stuff that's going to be in the water, you can just dissolve it in water yourself instead of having the companies ship water from place to place. Why are we doing this? Never do I think to myself, oh, this is less effective than other cleaning products. It's just not. It's effective, it's easy, and it's affordable. Blue Land has a special offer right now for our listeners. You can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/dearhank. You don't want to miss out, everybody. blueland.com/dearhank for 15% off. That's blueland.com/dearhank to get 15% off.
Now, we all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there shouldn't be any compromise. So don't go back to that one doctor who uses your appointment to catch up on all the latest headlines or their family group chat or their crossword puzzles just because they're available right now, or take your slightly sketchy insurance. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable, listen to you, and prioritize your health. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Go to ZocDoc.com/DearHank and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/DearHank. ZocDoc.com/DearHank.
All right, Hank. So my computer stopped recording, and therefore you missed some gold, people of the internet. I was really hard on Hank.
We got half of it. We got my part.
I was really hard on Hank for recently losing some gold, and then I just lost some solid gold. We had some high quality gold, but instead we're going to do the news from Mars and AFC Wimbledon so I can go pick up my children from school. I'll start. The news from AFC Wimbledon is that we still have not lost a game since I visited. I don't know if it's about me, but nice. We haven't lost a game. That said, we did tie 1-1 in the FA Cup, which you'll recall, Hank, is a cup competition. It's a knockout competition. It's separate from the league campaign. We played Weymouth, who ply their trade way down in the sixth tier of English football. And we tied them, which means we have to play them again in a week. And I mean, it was not a great tie for us. They had more shots than we did, more possessions, more corner kicks. In almost every way, they were the better team. And that's not good because they're in the sixth tier of English football and we should be comfortably outplaying them. So it's a little alarming as ties go, but it is still a continuation of the undefeated since John watched us lose streak.
This week in Mars news, Mars's crust might be a little more complex than we thought. We used to think that Mars's crust was like a, just a uniform basalt. So that's like a igneous rock that was part of an ocean of magma that coated the planet until it all cooled down into the crust. But researchers studying data from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter have found that the crust in the southern hemisphere of Mars has feldspar, which is usually found in silica-rich lava as opposed to basaltic flows. And that means that the crust might not have been formed by the cooling of one giant ocean of magma. Instead, it might have formed in multiple different phases. But it's going to take a lot more work to figure out what exactly is going on with Mars's crust. Also, the InSight lander, I think, probably just sent us its last photo. It's ending up. It's a beautiful little photo, and you can go look at it by searching for last InSight lander photo, because it did its thing and didn't get what a lot of Mars missions get, which is way longer life than they're planned for, but did do a lot of its work.
Well, Godspeed to a real one.
That's right. That's right. John, thank you for making a podcast with me. And thank you to everybody for sending your questions to hankandjohn@gmail.com. This podcast is edited by Joseph Tunamedish. It's produced by Rosianna Hals-Rojas. Our communications coordinator is Brooke Shotwell. Our editorial assistant is Debuki Chakravarti. The music you're hearing now is by the Greek Gunnarola. And as they say in our hometown,
don't forget to be awesome.